This is Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's weekly media roundtable when we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Hurricane Dorian, that's left a path of destruction in its wake in the Bahamas and is now lashing the east coast of the United States where it's just made landfall. The Category 5 storm surge has killed at least 30 people and has severely damaged homes, hospitals, and other structures. So coming up in this first half hour, we'll discuss the impact of the storm and how the media has covered it so far. We're joined this first half hour by Bob Berwin, a freelance environmental reporter who writes for a number of publications, including Inside Climate News, and was an international correspondent for Santa Barbara-based Pacific Standard magazine, which unfortunately shut down recently due to loss of funding. Bob joins us from Colorado. Good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
And we're also joined by Henry Fountain, a reporter and editor at the New York Times and the author of the book The Great Quake, How the Biggest Earthquake in North America Changed Our Understanding of the Planet. And he joins us from New York. Thanks for joining us, Henry.
Thanks for having me.
And later in the show, we'll be discussing AB 5, a California measure that would extend labor protections and benefits to workers labeled as independent contractors. It could have a major impact on gig economy contractors and the companies that rely on them, like Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash. And we'll be joined by Lauren Gurley at that point in the second half hour of the show. We'll open the phone lines here in just about 10 minutes for questions for our guests, but you can drop us a line now at yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on our website now at yourcallradio.org. And once we open the phone lines, the number will be 866-798-TALK to dial in. So, Henry Fountain, let me start with you. What's the latest on Hurricane Dorian right now?
The latest is that it's made landfall in the Outer Banks, you know, the easternmost part of North Carolina. I believe it's now down to a Category 1 storm. It was a Category 5 over the Bahamas. So it's lost a lot of energy, which is not unusual. I think top wind speeds are around 95 miles an hour, sustained wind speeds. And hurricanes lose energy when they strike land. You know, the land and everything on it absorbs a lot of the energy of a storm. But there's still high winds and there's still storm surge as the hurricane winds push water onto land. I believe in parts of North Carolina there's been a storm surge of about 7 feet, which is a lot less than the 23 or whatever feet it was in the Bahamas, but still potentially very destructive and deadly.
And you mentioned the big storm surge in the Bahamas. Can you describe for listeners the path that this hurricane took and the particularly devastating impact that it had in the Bahamas?
Right. Well, like a lot of these storms, or most of these storms, form in the tropics off the coast of Africa. That's where they start. And the prevailing winds blow them to the west, and this one followed that kind of track into the Caribbean. What happened over the Bahamas is the storm stalled for some reason, and meteorologists are not completely sure, but they think obviously what happened was that those winds weakened at some point, and so the forward movement, which had been about maybe 10 to 12 miles an hour, slowed to about a mile an hour, and that was really devastating for the Bahamas. If you have Category 5 winds, which are above 160 miles an hour, over a piece of land for 24 to 36 to 48 hours, that's really going to do a lot of damage. And it's also going to push a lot of water onto the land, and the Bahamas is very, very low-lying as it is, so that's why you see these incredible images of destruction in the Bahamas. And then, like a lot of storms, it shifted course as it ran into sort of a trough of low-pressure air that was over the southeast. And that's not that unusual either. That sort of changed its course from westerly to sort of north by northwest. And now as it's traveling up the coast, it's getting steered by the sort of common prevailing west to east winds that occur in the mid-Atlantic and, in fact, over large parts of the United States. So now it's sort of hugging the coast. It will eventually go out further into the ocean. It might go over Nova Scotia and Canada. But that's a very fairly typical track for a storm like this.
And I mentioned in the intro just the amount of destruction that we've been seeing from this storm, at least 30 people dead. I've seen thousands of people potentially missing right now, so that death toll is unfortunately likely to go up. And this is the fourth Category 5 hurricane storm that we've had in just the last 4 years, and this is now becoming a pattern. And Bob Berwin, let me bring you in on this discussion. What have you seen in terms of the media coverage from print and broadcast media? Has it changed its coverage of these storms over the last few years, given that their occurrence has been increasing in frequency?
I think that there has been more discussion about how global warming and the buildup of greenhouse gases from fossil fuel combustions may be affecting hurricanes, which is good. I've seen more coverage in the media about resilience in the face of not just hurricanes, but other extreme weather events, which I think is good, and I'd like to see that. And so I think the general level of climate literacy is inching upward, thanks to excellent work by organizations like the New York Times and Inside Climate News as well. So those are kind of the changes that I've noticed in the last few years.
And do you feel like the media is doing a good job communicating the science on this? And can you describe a little bit of what the science is telling us is happening with these hurricanes?
There's a lot of different areas of science that are exploring the links between global warming and hurricanes. I'd hate to generalize and say the media is doing a good job or a bad job. I mean, I look for media voices that I know are reliable and that do a good job. So I can't say in general if they are or not. Some of the things that I've written about and interviewed researchers about, specifically, let's say, related to Hurricane Dorian, are shifts in the way hurricanes behave. And one of the basic things I think that's good to realize, and that also helps with general climate literacy, is that all weather events are happening in a climate that has already been changed quite a bit by human activity. We're about 1 degree warmer than we were 100 or 150 years ago. And that's an incredible amount of additional heat in the climate system, in the atmosphere, in the oceans. And it's just logical that that's going to affect almost all weather events. Exactly how that happens is not totally clear yet.
Well, I want to talk more about the coverage of the science and how the science plays into these storms. And I also want to open the phone lines at this point for listeners. So we want to hear from you as well if you have questions about the coverage of Hurricane Dorian and climate change and where you think climate change should fit into your list of priorities in terms of the upcoming presidential election, which this will hopefully be an important topic here. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org, or better yet, you can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. So we'd love to hear from you on your thoughts on the coverage of what's happening with Hurricane Dorian. Henry Fountain, let me go back to you to ask you a similar question I asked to Bob. I mean, what's your take on how the media has been covering these more intense, more frequent hurricanes that have unfortunately seem to become commonplace now?
I think, you know, again, it's sort of hard to sort of pinpoint one media outlet or another. I think in general, as Bob said, coverage has improved, communication has improved. There's more of a, you know, sort of sense of giving sort of context of what's going on. And particularly in the case of, you know, you mentioned a lot of Category 5 hurricanes in the last couple of years. And while it's, you know, you can't really look at one hurricane and say climate change caused that hurricane. You might be able to say climate change made it worse, but you can't really say it caused that hurricane. But one of the things that scientists are talking about is that, in fact, as the planet warms, there should be maybe not more hurricanes every season, but more intense hurricanes, more Cat 4s, more Cat 5s. And in fact, so the fact that there have been four or five Cat 5 hurricanes over the last 3 or 4 years is in keeping with that idea. So while there's not absolute proof, there's a lot of sort of suggestions that what scientists have said is going to happen is happening.
I mean, certainly as I read some of the science on this, the scientists don't claim that climate change, is, as you mentioned, is causing hurricanes, but it's making them worse, and that some of this behavior we're seeing with Category 5 storms like Dorian, where it was stalled over the Bahamas, as you mentioned, for what seemed like an interminable amount of time, I'm sure, especially for people on the ground, that was something they had predicted as well. And can you describe a little bit about why climate change might be making these storms worse? What are you hearing from the scientific community?
Well, sure. I mean, the main driver of a hurricane is heat, and particularly warm water. That's the fuel that gives a hurricane strength and strengthens hurricanes. And so if the ocean is warming, which we know it is, then there's more energy, more fuel for a hurricane to make hurricanes worse. So that's one of the main reason behind the thinking that as the climate continues to warm, there'll be more intense hurricanes. But the other thing, a very basic thing, is that warm air holds more moisture than cooler air. So in a warmer atmosphere, you're going to get more rain, essentially, more precipitation. And we've seen that with a lot of recent hurricanes. I mean, Hurricane Harvey over Texas over Houston was the sort of prime example of it. It stalled, and it dumped something like 50 inches of rain on Houston over 3 days. So both of those things related to warming. We're seeing it, as I said, you can't necessarily say, oh, this one hurricane was definitely caused by climate change, but climate change definitely makes things worse.
And Bob Berwin, you know, this is potentially an example of how climate change is making things worse, as Henry just mentioned. And as these disasters come up, this is always becoming an opportunity potentially to educate the public about the science of climate change and how it is making some of these extreme weather events more intense, more frequent, more likely to occur. What do you feel like is the responsibility of the media to call attention to climate change when they have these natural disasters occurring and some immediate reporting needs to cover? I mean, how should the media be balancing that tension of understanding the long-term picture here, but also focusing on the short-term mm-hmm. events and destruction and human suffering?
Sure. I think there's a couple of different levels of responsibility there. One is to try and communicate the complex science as clearly as possible so that we can increase perhaps overall general climate literacy. I think another big responsibility, especially of local media, say local newspapers and so forth, is to hold local governments accountable for making sure that they are actually preparing for impacts that are happening and that are ahead. I think I'll stick to that. I think those are the two main areas. I guess overall, what I'd like to see is more focus on resilience and preparedness, and really, you know, trying to protect communities. I think that's where a lot of media could step up rather than just focusing on a disaster as it happens and the effects is more sustained ongoing coverage in helping to make sure the need for preparedness and resilience and recovery and adaptation.
And I definitely want to get into these questions around resilience for communities like Bahamas, countries like Bahamas, where they are going to have to be dealing with more intense storms like this. But just staying on this question about the role of the media in communicating the science on this. So, Bob, do you think that the scientific community needs to also step up a bit here, too? I mean, there's this idea with scientists that, you know, they don't want to say anything's definitive. And, you know, it's hard for them, I think, to communicate the risks here, just the nature of their profession and the way that scientists tend to talk. Do you think that's contributing potentially to the way the media might be portraying the way that climate change is impacting some of these extreme weather events?
I think that was true up until a few years ago, but I think in the last few years, I think there are a lot of scientists who are willing to speak out very, very clearly about this. I was on another radio program just an hour ago in Florida, and I shared that with a scientist, a sea level scientist who was very clear. And you know, I mean, I could name names, but there are a lot of scientists who are really good communicators and who are willing to go on radio and interviews and explain this stuff. So I do not think that's as much of a problem as it was a few years ago.
All right. Well,
can I just weigh in here and say,
sure,
I think Bob's absolutely right. That's my experience too. That there's a lot of scientists who view this as a crucial, critical issue for the world, and are realizing that they need to speak out and communicate clearly. So it really has changed in the last 3 or 4 years.
All right, and that's helpful to know that the media is, you and the media are noticing that the change in the scientific community is happening. Well, for those of you just joining us, we're discussing Hurricane Dorian on Your Call's Media Roundtable, which we hold weekly on this program. And we're discussing the media coverage of the storm. It's now made landfall in the United States, but just left a terrible path of destruction in the Bahamas in particular. And we're joined by Bob Berwin, a freelance environmental reporter writing for a number of publications, including Inside Climate News. And we're also joined by Henry Fountain, reporter and editor at The New York Times and author of the book The Great Quake, How the Biggest Earthquake in North America Changed Our Understanding of the Planet. The phone lines are open if you'd like to join this conversation. To do so, the number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email with any questions or comments you have at yourcall@kalw.org, or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. We'd love to hear from you on this topic and any questions you have for our guests. Well, Henry Fountain, going back to you on a point that Bob just made about the importance of the media focusing on adaptation, preparedness for these kinds of storms. Can you just first describe what do you think is going to come next now for places like the Bahamas that were so devastated by the storm?
Well, obviously there's a lengthy recovery period, and as we've seen in places like Puerto Rico and Barbuda, that the recovery can take years, and in fact may take a decade or more. So the Bahamas, particularly those two islands, Grand Bahama and Abaco, have a really long road ahead. In terms of protecting islands like those from hurricanes, as hurricanes become more intense, I'm not sure how much can really be done. I mean, obviously, there's ways to build homes that allow storm surge to go underneath that are strong enough to withstand really high wind speeds. But when you have an island that's covered in 23 feet or 25 feet of surging seawater, it's hard to see how to protect that property, those properties. But in other locations, as Bob was alluding to, I mean, the focus needs to be more on mitigating the damage from the next storm. If there's no way to do it, perhaps adapting and moving, finding a different place to live, all those things have to be considered. I think, we were talking about how the coverage right now is of the disaster, and that's very common. I mean, I think it goes beyond the media. We all tend to be very reactive to things. We react to things as they're happening, and particularly a horrific event like this. The media needs to be, and society in general, needs to be more proactive about things, about planning for the next disaster and ways of mitigating it.
Well, and planning is something that, it's not a lot of political rewards for those politicians who are going to invest in, all sorts of infrastructure to become more resilient, more prepared. And so it seems like it takes, public opinion to really get behind this. And the media can play an important role in illuminating these issues for people about how important it is to invest in those preparedness type measures. But at the same time, these storms, they get a lot of headlines with the destruction. But do you feel like the media is doing a good enough job with the follow-up, revisiting places, highlighting those issues about, the need to rebuild in a smart way? I mean, you mentioned Hurricane Harvey in Houston, and there was so much damage to homes there, but you don't see a lot of the coverage about, what it's like for homeowners on the ground. I mean, I'm not saying that coverage isn't there, but it just doesn't seem to get the attention that disaster gets.
I mean, the coverage is definitely there. I know that at the New York Times, which is really the only outlet that I can speak for, but we've covered the aftermath of Harvey extensively. We covered the aftermath of Sandy, which affected New York City. We're still covering it. But again, the problem is everybody tends to be reactive to things, and so sort of the long-term look, I mean, the disaster captures the headline to get people to focus on the sort of less intense stories that follow is difficult. I mean, all we can do is try, and again, speaking only for my news organization, we definitely try.
All right. Well, and listeners can check out the New York Times and read all that coverage online or subscribe to the hard copy of the newspaper if you're kind of old school in that way. Bob Berwin, I wanted to ask you on this point about media coverage of climate change, climate science. We saw a pretty landmark event happen this week with CNN actually hosting a 7-hour town hall with 10 of the Democratic candidates for president on climate change. And it covered a whole host of issues, including the impacts of natural disasters. It was 7 hours of conversation with these candidates. And again, the first time we've seen an extended discussion on this issue with presidential candidates. I mean, famously in 2016, the issue of climate change didn't even come up in any of the presidential debates. So do you think this is a sign of a shift in how the media is going to cover climate change with respect to the presidential race? I mean, how significant was that town hall on CNN, in your opinion?
Wow. Well, I hope it marks a shift. And I'm speaking for myself now, not as representing Inside Climate News, and also keep in mind that I write mostly about climate science and not climate politics. But speaking as a very interested citizen and as a journalist, I would say that, you know, having a climate-focused discussion on a major network like CNN is a huge shift from what we've seen in past election years, and it's very important. And I think as far as the media role, the biggest thing is going to be to hold these people accountable to what they say and make sure that it actually happens if one of those candidates gets elected, you know, to make sure that they actually follow up. And I will say, too, that just from listening to parts of the discussion that, you know, I think most of the statements made by the candidates are fairly well based in science, but not all of them. And that's a tough thing for listeners or viewers to discern. And that speaks to a greater overall need for climate literacy in the media and in the general public. We can talk about all this stuff we want, but, you know, if people don't have the basic sort of scientific understanding of what we're talking about, I'm not sure how useful it is, you know, to just have people uttering sound bites about climate. So I advocate for much more climate literacy in the media and in the general public.
And do you feel the media has an important role to fact check climate science from candidates?
I would say that would be very useful, yes.
And Henry Fountain, let me ask you a similar question, teeing off of this CNN town hall on climate change. Do you think that Hurricane Dorian and the coverage here that we're now seeing with CNN, do you think that's going to have a lasting impact on this debate going forward? Do you think it's going to impact the debate in the presidential campaign in particular?
Well, I hope it does. I mean, climate change needs to be talked about at the highest levels of government and society. I have to say, I just read a story an hour or two ago about the ratings for that 7-hour climate debate, for lack of a better term, and the ratings were pretty bad. I mean, they were much lower than Fox News or MSNBC over the same time period. So, you know, there's a question of how many people it reached. I think any effort to reach people is great, and hopefully, as the subject is not a taboo during the 2020 campaign, that people will get even more interested in it and pay attention.
So, as a bit of a cautionary note, then, if the ratings weren't that significant for it, but it's still, I think, a notable development in terms of media coverage of climate change and some of these extreme weather events like Hurricane Dorian. Well, I want to thank our guests. We're going to have to leave the conversation there. Thank you so much to Bob Berwin, freelance environmental reporter who writes for publications like Inside Climate News. Thanks so much for joining us, Bob.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
And I also want to thank Henry Fountain, reporter and editor at The New York Times and author of The Great Quake, How the Biggest Earthquake in North America Changed Our Understanding of the Planet. Thank you, Henry.
Thanks so much. Good to talk to you.
All right. And we'll be back on your call after this short break. Those of you just joining us now, I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call in our weekly media roundtable. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Well, we're going to shift gears now to talk about another important topic that has been getting more attention in recent weeks, and that is Assembly Bill 5 in California. Now, if it becomes law, AB 5 would change the definition of what it means to be an employee in California by extending labor protections and benefits like health care, overtime, and minimum wage to many workers who are labeled as independent contractors in the gig economy. And the two companies that are getting the bulk of the attention on this issue are the ride-hailing companies Uber and Lyft. So to discuss coverage of Assembly Bill 5 and its implications, we're joined on the phone from New York by Lauren Gurley. Lauren is a staff writer at Vice News Motherboard, covering the labor movement in the tech sector. Good to have you on, Lauren.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. And we want to invite listeners to call in with questions, and we'll open those phone lines in about 10 minutes for this segment here. And that number, again, is 866-798-TALK. But as we mentioned, you can send an email now at yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on our website at yourcallradio.org. Well, first of all, Lauren, can you just describe a bit about what AB5 does and how it sort of came about?
Yeah, so I think an important question to ask is why in recent years has there been so much news about, you know, Lyft and Uber drivers going through so much pain and misery in their jobs, why drivers are sleeping in their cars, why they're taking out loans against their cars, and in the case of New York, a few drivers have even committed suicide. And I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that drivers don't receive a lot of the protections and benefits that most workers in the United States do, like overtime pay, minimum wage laws they're not subject to, disability insurance, paid vacation days, paid sick days, paid family leave, all of these things. They don't have the right to form unions. And so essentially what AB 5 does is it provides, essentially what has been going on is that Uber and Lyft have been exploiting this loophole where they've classified drivers as independent contractors instead of employees. And so what AB 5 does is it would change that classification, and they would have all of these rights and benefits that they've previously been excluded from. It came about in 2018. There was a ruling in a California Supreme Court that said that truck drivers at a company called Dynamex were being misclassified as independent contractors instead of employees. And so what AB 5 does is it takes that ruling and it codifies it into law so that it will affect workers who have been misclassified across a range of industries, including construction, domestic workers, not just Uber and Lyft, but a ton of different gig economy apps.
Well, so as you mentioned, we had this Supreme Court ruling regarding truck drivers. Why was there the need for legislation? What did the Supreme Court ruling leave open that the legislature needed to step in to codify?
So essentially it was just like in a stage of limbo. I'm not sure like fully what was missing, but it wasn't being enforced. And so basically when it goes into law if it passes the Senate, I believe, on Tuesday, and then if Governor Newsom signs the bill, then it will be applied across, you know, it will be applied to all these other companies. Basically, what will happen is that companies will face an ABC test, which determines whether or not a worker is an employee or an independent contractor. And if they're going to classify workers as independent contractors, they're going to have to fulfill three things. One is that the worker is free from the company's control. The second is that the worker provides services that aren't central to the company's business model. And the third is that the worker runs an independent business. Now, all three of those things would be very hard to prove that Uber and Lyft drivers fit. And so I think while Uber and Lyft will challenge it in the courts, and they're trying to get a ballot initiative already, they've sort of said that they would spend $90 million on something like that in 2020, I think they're going to have a very hard time challenging it.
Well, I certainly want to get into some of the next steps here if the bill passes. But first, I just want to ask a couple of questions about some of the basics of the bill. I mean, you talked about how a lot of this seems to be coming out of Uber and Lyft drivers and the suffering that they've been going through as independent contractors. But then we have a Supreme Court case that's about truck drivers. So exactly which workers in our economy are going to be affected by this? I mean, beyond Uber and Lyft and truck drivers, how wide-ranging could this bill be in terms of its effect on workers in our economy?
Yeah, so in California, I've read that it's probably around 2 million workers that could possibly be affected. They are, like, exempting certain workers, like hairstylists, lawyers, attorneys, of certain who workers that have, like, private practices and stuff like that. But I do believe it will be applied to domestic workers, so people who clean houses, construction workers. That's a huge industry in California, that workers are generally classified as independent contractors. And then all of these somewhat smaller apps like DoorDash and Handy, and there are, you know, dozens of them. So those are the main, the biggest ones. I think construction is huge, I believe there are 200,000 Lyft and Uber drivers in California, roughly.
So 2 million is a lot. I mean, we're a state of 40 million, so that's 2 million people's lives could be greatly affected by this bill if it passes. And then in practice, how would it work? Let's say you're an Uber driver who just drives 6 to 8 hours a week. Now, are you all of a sudden going to have to be a full-time employee or have contracts where you're now going to have to drive a certain amount of hours? How does that work in terms of people's daily lives if this bill passes?
Yeah, so it's not entirely clear. I think that Uber and Lyft have used a lot of sort of corporate scare tactics to say, you know, like, once this bill passes, all of your flexibility will go away as a driver. In fact, they sent out an in-app notification to all of their drivers a few days ago that said, in a few days, California lawmakers will vote on AB 5, a bill that would remove your flexibility to drive when and how you want to. They've also said in, like, a press statement, we would likely have to exert more control over our workers, telling them where to work, how to work, and who they can work for. Uber said they would likely hire far fewer drivers than they currently support, and that they'd have to require a minimum number of hours per week. I feel like those things wouldn't necessarily, I mean, Uber and Lyft's business model will both, companies will clearly have to change some things because paying for all of these benefits for workers is not cheap. But I don't quite see how flexibility plays into that. Flexibility is something that the technology, the app offers. That is great, and I don't think it has anything to do with providing their workers with things like a minimum wage or like overtime pay. I mean, they may require that workers don't work over 40 hours a week, which could affect things. But, you know, the way things are now, the rates for drivers have dropped so much over the past few years. Since Uber and Lyft IPO'd earlier this year, workers in many cities, like in Los Angeles, for example, they saw their wages drop from 80 cents a mile to 60 cents a mile. So, like, things are incredibly dire. People are living out of their cars and, like I said, taking out loans against their cars and are living in debt. And so I think having good jobs is probably better having good jobs at fewer of them is probably better than having, you know, this system where as dozens of people are signing up for the app every day, or hundreds of people are signing up for the app every single day, and creating the system where these are, you know, jobs with really, really bad working conditions.
So, you know, beyond the sort of the working condition, you know, aspects of this, has anyone taken a look at what the likely economic impacts would be? I mean, you know, we always hear businesses really just sort of cry doom and gloom about new regulatory impacts, and often they're able to absorb them without as much of a hitch as they often will say publicly. You know, but at the same time, it seems like prices would rise for a lot of the things that people have sort of grown accustomed to using at a pretty affordable rate. I mean, a cheap Uber ride, a cheap Lyft ride, et cetera. Prices might rise, as you mentioned, on different, you know, construction projects, homes that people are buying. And at the same time, you'd have these contractors with more money in their pockets, potentially, that they would be spending and circulating the economy. So it seems like there's a lot of moving parts here. And has anyone tried to get a sense of what's likely to happen if this bill passes? Because it seems like it would have a major impact on the economy.
Yeah, that's for sure. It's sort of hard to say what will happen exactly. Like, clearly when... there have been a lot of studies that have been done. When you raise the minimum wage, a lot of times the economy does better, like you said, because people have more money to spend and things like that. The issue with Uber and Lyft's business model is that they lose millions of dollars every day, and they've never made a profit. And the reason why they continue to exist is because investors pour in billions of dollars into their company. Now, if they stopped doing that, Uber and Lyft's business model would quickly crumble. Like, say, there might be a recession soon and people stop investing in pouring money into Uber and Lyft. Like, that could hurt them too. So it's unclear in the long run how this would affect Uber and Lyft, but their business model basically has been so successful. They've spread through so many different markets so quickly, basically by circumventing basic protections and basic labor laws that most workers have. And so if this really is a labor model that is built on, you know, exploiting workers and, you know, making them work to the bone, driving them to the bone, like, I'm not so sure that it is a good one for us to have.
Sure. All right. Well, so for those of you just joining us, we are discussing Assembly Bill 5 in California. It's currently being debated here in the final weeks of the California legislature. It would be a bill that would reclassify independent contractors working for gig economy companies like Uber and Lyft, but also, as we just heard, construction companies. It would reclassify them as employees with all the benefits that would come with that reclassification. And we are discussing this issue with Lauren Gurley, a staff writer at Vice News Motherboard, covering the labor movement in the tech sector. We want to hear from you. We're opening the phone lines now. What do you think about these app-based companies and their business models? And particularly if you drive for Lyft or Uber, we want to hear from you. And we also want to hear from you if you take Uber and Lyft, what your thoughts are on this bill. You can join the conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org, or better yet, leave your comment at yourcallradio.org. Well, Lauren, I wanted to ask you about the politics of this. So who exactly instigated this bill? I mean, you mentioned that Uber and Lyft drivers have been suffering and struggling. Were they the ones who have started to push this bill forward? We know Uber and Lyft and other companies are opposed. Who's on different sides of the fence on this issue right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the bill was originally written by Lorena Gonzalez, I believe her name is, who is a Democrat from San Diego in the Assembly. And you should fact check me on that. I don't know if she's in the Assembly or in the Senate. But she proposed
She's in the Assembly.
Okay. Thanks. So after this Dynamex decision was decided, she wrote up this bill and quickly, I mean, she has deep ties with labor unions in California, and so she quickly got these huge unions on board, like SEIU, Service Employees International United, which is one of the biggest unions in the country, as well as the Teamsters, which is a truck drivers union, also very big, and they started organizing worker Lyft and Uber drivers throughout California. There's an organization in the Bay Area called Gig Workers Rising that they've worked with, and then there's a similar organization in Los Angeles that has been getting large groups of drivers together across the state in those two, North and South, and having them reach out to other drivers. They recently did a caravan across the state to I think that was last week, to protest outside of Uber's headquarters in San Francisco, and then that's on the Capitol steps in Sacramento. Now, on the other side of things, Uber and Lyft have also been organizing drivers against the bill. Like I said, they frequently send notifications. They frequently sent out notifications to drivers to sign petitions or to call Governor Newsom and tell him not to sign the bill, which is something that happened last week. They've paid drivers to attend rallies in Sacramento. They don't actually pay them. They say, you know, we'll pay for your gas. We'll pay for your lunch if you show up at this. And, you know, hold a sign. And drivers are also very much on there's a huge group of drivers who are also very much on the side of Lyft and Uber, saying that they believe this would reduce their flexibility. Now, the big question, question mark here is Governor Newsom, who has been seen as an ally of big tech, while simultaneously being a friendly towards big labor unions. He did come out with an op-ed in the Sacramento Bee last weekend saying he supported the bill, which people took to mean that he'll sign it, but I'm personally not so certain about that. He's been meeting privately with top executives from Lyft and Uber and trying to come up with a compromise that makes everyone happy. So I'm not so certain that we will just see the bill go right through without any sort of amendments that he might make to it.
All right, so some complicated politics and still a lot to be determined here. Let's go to the phone lines. We have Benjamin calling from San Francisco. Benjamin, welcome to your call.
Hi, thank you very much. I was curious if you could speak to, I noticed you mentioned that certain professions such as hairdressers and attorneys who are regulated under the DCA would be unaffected by this. And but I know, I'm a court reporter, and when the Dynamex decision came down, people in our industry, you know, there's a lot of talk about it. We're mostly independent contractors that work for agencies. And I know that some massage therapists went into kind of a different posture where they stopped being independent and places started hiring employees. I was just wondering if you know if the bill is like, does it simply affect people who are not regulated by the DCA, or are there specific industries spelled out in the bill?
All right, so thank you, Benjamin, for that question. So, Lauren, yeah, do you want to respond to Benjamin's question about who's exempt and how?
Certainly. Sorry. As far as I know, all of these industries, like, it's laid out very clearly which industries are part of it and which of them are not. I know that a lot of journalists, a lot of freelance journalists, a lot of reporters, like you mentioned, have been very concerned about what it would do to their work. And I think that's a really serious concern. I can't claim that I'm an expert on what would happen. I'm also a journalist, so that is something I care about a lot, and it would be something that I'd have to look into more. But yes, the industries are very clearly laid out, and as the bill has moved through Congress, there have been some changes
through the legislature.
There have been some changes made into which workers would be in which categories. As recently as a few weeks ago.
And for those of you interested in this debate, you can follow it on at the state legislature's website, leginfo.gov. You can see the bill there and get the latest, and also call your state assembly member or senator if you want to weigh in on this. But Benjamin, thank you for calling in. Let's go back to the phone lines. Lawrence from San Francisco dialing in. Welcome to your call.
Thank you. My name is Lawrence Paul, and I own a San Francisco taxi medallion, and my wife and my retirement was greatly injured and reduced due to the unscrupulous behavior of the Uber and Lyft management, who have been paying off assemblymen and state senators for years to fight the blue-collar worker in San Francisco. And I want to applaud the presenter and anybody who will get fired up when hearing this radio show and call their state assemblyman and state senator, as I'm going to do as soon as I get back to my house, and plead with them to please sign the, please support this bill, because Uber and Lyft have been riding a wave of basically doing everything that has been said so far, and now committing $90 million again to fight one of the weakest parts or one of the most disenfranchised part of our worker economy, which is the blue-collar worker, who is not represented because of their position in the economic structure of our society.
Well, Lawrence, thank you for calling in and giving a voice to that perspective, because definitely with the advent of Uber and Lyft, we know that taxi drivers like yourself have definitely been injured, and so it's important to hear your voice. And Lauren, I wanted to give you a chance to comment at all on Lawrence's comment. I'm sure you've heard similar sentiment, and there are going to be these competing industries that I would imagine are very much sort of salivating at the opportunity to have a more level playing field, as they would see it, with these gig economy companies. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a huge issue in New York City, obviously, where I am. Most of the driver suicides have actually not been Lyft and Uber drivers. They've been medallion owners who've seen, their medallions, like you said, go from being worth, at least in New York, being worth, over $1 million to these people being in lots and lots of debt. I think that there could be a very positive impact in the fact that, Lyft and Uber, if this passes and in fact they have to start following these rules, like I said, they may have fewer drivers on, there may be a cap on, how many drivers they put on the road, and they may have to raise their prices, which will obviously help out the yellow cabs and, other industries that have been hurt by gig economy apps, paying or offering such low rates by skirting around basic labor protections will probably also have a better chance of competing. But thank you for calling in. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Lawrence. And back to the phone lines again. We have John in San Francisco calling in. John, welcome to your call.
Hey, this is John from San Francisco. Thanks for taking my call. I was a former bike messenger, and they take advantage of bike messengers exactly the same way that they are taking advantage of these drivers. You're not an independent contractor. You're an employee. And this has been proven with bike messengers through the filing of an IRS form called the SS-8. Which is basically a series of questions, if I remember right, about 50 questions asking you how you go about the course of your day. Are you directed by your employer to do certain things? Are you provided equipment in the course of this job? And all these things basically add up to the obvious answer of yes, you're an employee. Every bike messenger I've ever known who's filed that claim has won their case and gotten back a bunch of money from their employers who like to keep it underground. But I'm just glad this is finally happening to these guys. I'm sorry it took so long, but I can't see how they can't win this.
All right, John, thank you for that comment. And, Lauren, we've just got about a minute left, so briefly, any thoughts in response to what John is describing, at least on the bike messenger side?
Yeah. I mean, yes, this is a huge issue for all of these messenger apps that have popped up, too. I think it's just important to note that it's not just Lyft and Uber. Like, there are hundreds of thousands of people working for other smaller apps that you may not have heard of. I was recently speaking to a woman who worked for an app called Handy, which is the domestic services app, house cleaning, who was, you know, went through a really bad car accident on her way between jobs and had to spend thousands of dollars because out of her own pocket because she didn't have workman's comp. Now that's a huge issue for people on bikes and stuff like that who might be hit or might be seriously injured, and they have to pay for everything out of their own pocket. So this would be a really big change for them.
Yeah, Lauren, we got to unfortunately bring this conversation to a close. But really quickly, for listeners, what are the next key milestones here in this legislative debate?
Yeah, so I believe next Tuesday might be slightly still up in the air. This is going to go to the Senate floor for a vote. It already passed the Assembly back in the spring, and it passed the Senate Appropriations Committee last week. And then sometime around September 13th, it will hit the desk of Governor Newsom for a final, his final approval. What he could do is add amendments to it, and then it would have to go back to the Senate, or he could just sign off on the whole thing. So that's
all right. Well, so it sounds like if you want to weigh in, call your state senator, contact the governor. We put that information on our website. And unfortunately, we're going to have to leave the conversation there. I want to thank Lauren Gurley for joining us, staff writer at Vice News Motherboard, covering the labor movement and the tech sector. Thanks so much, Lauren.
Thank you.
And thank you to all of us for joining us. I'm sorry we weren't able to get to all of your calls. But to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. You can follow us on Twitter at yourcallradio and email any show ideas and feedback you have to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.